I'm Freddie, host of Unforgotten, a podcast series which dives into the 2009 unsolved murder of Matt Stewart. The following is a special question and answer episode, featuring a conversation recorded earlier this week between myself and Steve, moderator of the Unforgotten Forum, located at unforgotten.freeforums.net. If you have any suggestions about topics or questions to be included in future special episodes, you can submit them on the forum. And now, here's the episode.
It's been just about a month since the last episode was released. I have been reflecting a lot on all that's happened, diving into this bizarre mystery. I thought it would be appropriate to record another question and answer on what we've learned so far. There have been many active users on the forum who have continued to post. I want to address some of the things that have been brought up as well. So the moderator, the king of the forum, Steve, is joined. We're going to go through some stuff.
Sounds great. It's good to be back. So what do you think you have in store over the next few months and for season two? Do you have a timetable? Do you know what you're intending?
I would say the short answer to that is no. I don't have a strict timetable. You know, when I started the one episode a month for 5 month timetable for season one, it wasn't arbitrary. It wasn't that I wanted to stop, really centered around the full-time job that I have coming up on a season that's going to be quite busy for me. With that coming up, I wanted to set some sort of deadline so that I didn't get too wrapped up in the podcast and the investigation and excitement of it all. Definitely be a couple of months before people should expect the second season to kick off. But as we talked about before, I'm committed to churning out some additional content. I've been working on continuing to dive into the mystery. Just over the last weekend, I did two interviews, spent collectively like 3 hours on the phone doing interviews that will likely be in season two. I'm not stopping anytime soon.
So I take it that behind the scenes, you're still handling whatever comes in. People have tips and things. Obviously, you still want to hear it. You're still looking for new information.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Probably in the last couple of weeks have been some of the more exciting bits of information that have come in, and still also active in seeking out additional media and other folks to take this story on, because I think that's important as well. But I've been super encouraged from the forum and the participation from listeners. If you're listening and haven't been on the forum, please do that. And if you've been posting, keep reading, invite your friends. We're going to keep going until we find the truth.
There's still information out there that's rumors in the community that has not been brought forward in any kind of a public forum, even to this point. It's surprising that there's all these little nooks and crannies where information hides. Many people seem to assume it's already out there and talked about, when in truth, most people have never heard it.
I think sometimes we take for granted what we may think is common knowledge. Assuming that other people know what you know can be really detrimental to a case like this. If you're out there and you feel like, oh, I've heard this, but I think everyone knows it, please just go ahead. Worst case scenario, we hear something that we've already heard before. You know, I think we need to be as thorough as possible. Everything helps.
And if you're not comfortable talking to Freddie or posting it on the forum, remember there's always the opportunity to call in an anonymous tip to the police department or call Mooresville Police Department itself and talk to the lead investigator. Pass on your information to them. Anything that they get, they should follow up on. Has that been your experience so far, Freddie, that if stuff's referred to the police, that you get the feeling it's being acted upon?
No.
Okay.
I'll be honest and say that I do not feel like tips are being acted upon or taken seriously at all, no. If you know something, please report it to the police department. I'm not saying don't do that, but in my experience, I don't feel confident that it is. And I'll tell you this, I was always tried to be as transparent as possible with the Mooresville PD, you know, let them know from the beginning that I was conducting these interviews at different points, divulged to them, you know, how, just how many interviews I had done, you know, let them know throughout the course of what I was doing that I would be happy to provide them with those interviews and the research that I came up with. Never once did they follow up with me and take me up on that offer. And in a case that is still unsolved, publicly, there's been no leads. I mean, publicly, the only thing that has been said since 2009 is that the case has been so hard to work because there's no solid leads, quote unquote, nothing solid to go on. Yet they're not taking me up on my offer to have the audio from the interviews that I've done.
It would seem that those interviews could show areas where maybe previous statements to the police are inconsistent with current statements to you. There might be information in there that would just help them narrow down the honesty of different individuals involved.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, anything you would think. I mean, the interviews that were in the podcast account for only some of the interviews that I actually have. There's a lot that I didn't put in for various reasons. So you would think that they would at least want to have that for future use, if anything else. So it just doesn't, none of it adds up.
Right. And does that go for the SBI as well? Have you offered them the same source material?
Yeah, they just referred me to the Mooresville Police Department.
So even though we have reason to believe from the stuff we learned early on that the SBI is working this in conjunction with Mooresville Police Department, it doesn't appear in actuality that the SBI is doing anything on their own?
I have no evidence of that. The folks that I've talked to that, you know, maybe have contacts at the SBI, not a lot of people over there have even heard about the case. I certainly don't think that the SBI is in any way more involved than Mooresville. It's been my impression that they've continued to let Mooresville take the lead on it. But my real concern is that when I've reached out with some really unsettling things, it seems to have been brushed aside completely. That to me doesn't seem like a situation where they just don't have anything to go on.
So what's the backstory behind how the SBI was involved in the first place? From what I had heard, right about the time of the murder, there was some problems in the Mooresville Police Department with other cases not going quite according to procedure. So the SBI was overseeing them? Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, well, there were some problems in the Mooresville Police Department before 2009. And then after 2009, there were some problems in the SBI. You know, well-publicized scandals that were happening within these agencies in and around this time. And some of this will be covered extensively in the second season of the podcast. I'm not going to be trying to skew anything or trying to make anyone look bad. That's not my prerogative. Ultimately, I know that what I want is the case solved, and I know I can't do it. I know the people that can are the Mooresville Police Department and the SBI. So, you know, looking back on what was in and what wasn't in the podcast, probably in the future, I'll be more transparent on some of the disappointment that I've had and some of just the obscurity and strangeness of the reactions that I've gotten when reporting very, very troubling things to law enforcement and basically getting nothing in response. In the future, I think I'm going to examine that a bit closer because I think we have to if we're going to be thorough, if we're going to be objective.
We look forward to it. So let's look back on season one a little bit and get what you think are some of the key takeaways to the season.
You know, starting off from before I started the podcast and then looking back after, I'd say the main difference between what I know now that I didn't know then for certain is that this was a targeted murder, not a random act. I can say that pretty much at this point with absolute sincere confidence. This was an assassination. And the evidence seems to point towards the attack being personal. That was probably the number one key takeaway for me. You know, probably another key takeaway is the secrecy surrounding this whole situation.
That's what seemed odd to me as well with my conversations with you. It seems the closer that you get to Matt himself, the less people want to talk.
Yeah, and the more forceful pushback I get too. It's a really odd situation. It could be the strangest part of this whole case. It's not just that no one will talk about it. We'll talk about it all day long. We just won't talk about who could have done it.
Right.
You know, other people on the forum have picked up on that.
We do have several threads that mention things like that. One of them's titled, "Why the We Just Want to Move On Answer Doesn't Work." Many people closely associated with Matt are willing to discuss the murder when it's framed from the standpoint of their own experience with it, but have no interest whatsoever in getting mainstream help on trying to find out who did it.
If you cross a certain point where you start asking questions, then the conversation stops completely. I guess all I can say is jarring. You know, there's something there. I don't know what it is. I guess that's what we're looking for. But to me, it's only strengthened my resolve.
So let's go back to one of the other key takeaways from this season. I think you pretty conclusively showed that it's very likely there were two guns used in the crime. Would you say that that's now pretty much an established fact?
Yes. Pretty much all the firearm experts that I've spoken with that I've showed the autopsy have conclusively said there, without a shadow of a doubt, there was two weapons.
So two guns and one knife as a minimum, right?
Yes.
And your FBI expert specifically said he felt that that meant two gunmen. It was not logical for there to be two guns involved for a single attacker.
Yes. Yes, he did.
So I know we have a thread on the forum about this, but what does that say about the case? That there were two people here when the media reports all suggest that it was described as a single gunman?
Well, I think it's exactly that. I mean, now you have a contrast between what the evidence is suggesting contrasted with the witness testimony. I don't think that the testimony and the evidence are necessarily mutually exclusive in that I think there is a possibility that what was experienced could have been just one person, but that also would add elements that would become unlikely. What you really have is a situation where, according to the witness testimony, the period of time in which this person or persons began the attack on Matt Stewart and the time that squad cars arrived at the scene, it's a period of about 4 minutes. You know, she ran across the street and dialed 911 at 12:45. By 12:49, they had arrived at the scene. So that's two individuals perpetrating all of this and leaving in that time period. You could have had one individual that was later joined by another, but it adds...
That eats up some of your time right there, sure.
Right, yeah. And, you know, the wounds are extensive. There's defensive wounds. It should be noted there was 100 minutes that passed before they actually went inside the house. But whatever happened, it was atypical in every which way. But I think you have to look at what was at all probable and in some cases what was possible. A takeaway from all of that is just that the evidence maybe cast some doubt on what was originally attested to. Not saying that it was definitively false or anything of that sort, but cast some doubt on it in my mind.
Sure. Now, none of the neighbors in close proximity recall hearing any gunshots or commotion or anything. You've made a fairly big deal out of that, both on the forums and in the podcast. So how do you feel that that's significant to the overall case?
I think it's significant in the context of the particular situation. I don't think that it's impossible that you could have a situation where firearms are going off in a quiet neighborhood and neighbors sleep through it. It's
not impossible. Not just neighbors, but the child down the hall.
Right. I've talked extensively, you know, I had an extended conversation with Dr. Melanick that wasn't in the podcast where, you know, she talked about how it's odd, you know, maybe odd, but it's also not, wouldn't be the first time, but it creates, I think with a lot of what we go over here in this different scenarios and things happening that alone, I think you could expect if you closely analyze any situation, there's maybe one or two things that are unlikely maybe that happen, but it's in conjunction with every other oddity that occurs that makes it relevant, if that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm. So a lot of people have brought up Matt's mother-in-law and her actions on the night of the murder, as to when she showed up at the house and what time, what she knew. Can you address that aspect of it?
Early on, I encountered these stories. I heard from neighbors, from friends, just about everyone that I interviewed wanted to talk about this aspect of Matt's mother-in-law, and that she had come from her house in another city. And she recounted that she was there because she had had a bad feeling in the middle of the night that something was wrong. So she got in her car and drove to her daughter's house. She arrived in the neighborhood after police had somewhat blocked off the street coming down Shepherd's Hill Drive. But there's an alternative way that you can kind of get around about if you were not to take Shepherd's Hill Drive directly, but to pass that and to continue down and to take the next right and to loop around. And what I'm told is that she used that to get around the barricade and to park in the driveway of the Stewart's house and to approach the house, but that she was stopped and she was not allowed to go in the house. Multiple people report seeing her there at the scene, seeing her car there at the scene, report her telling them about this directly after the murder. Probably close to a dozen people that I've spoken with that have heard this directly from her. Some of the neighbors talking about her car being taken in for evidence, you know, what they saw that was taken out of her car, and, you know, what they personally attest to hearing from state investigators. So that's how that all came up. I wasn't able to get her side of the story, which was a shame, and I wish I could get some explanation on it.
And unfortunately, it seems like the only source for that explanation would be the mother-in-law herself.
Yes, and she is unwilling to go on the record to speak with me on the podcast, although she'll say some other things off the record. Other conversations have been less constructive.
Would you consider giving her the option of making a statement that you would add into the podcast unedited if she did want to address some of these issues?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That'd be phenomenal. Any movement towards addressing this publicly?
So there's a lot of little theories that have been put up on the forums that have not been addressed on the podcast. I wanted to hit you up with a couple of them and see if they are things that you've heard about and done any investigation into. For one, we've got a post or two about an ex-boyfriend of Angel's, and some saying that after the murder, she went to live with this ex-boyfriend. Is that accurate?
The way that the question is phrased is misleading and maybe neglects some of the nuances of the situation. And that sounds that sounds like a dodge, but it's, you know, it may be something that I have to address in future episodes, but it's something that I've taken very seriously. What I would say is the individuals that Angel stayed with after this happened were close family friends with a lot of land. So the digging that I've done, I don't think there's as much there as would maybe be gleaned from that post. It's not as sensational as that post may be interpreted. You know, people can do their own research and come to their own conclusions, but the way that the post was made was a bit sensationalized.
Another one that attracted a lot of attention and got me thinking immediately was one suggesting that there was a family member of Matt's that was being suspected at some point, and that it might have even been someone associated with the police.
Also a very nuanced, complex situation. I think both of these that you've mentioned so far are addressed in interviews that were not aired, that may be aired in the future. Certainly points of interest. And it may seem odd that I started out in the beginning, like, I'm going to follow every lead. You know, it was weird because it was happening in real time. The bulk of everything I started getting was not until after the episodes started coming out month by month. And there are certain parts of the story that I really didn't feel like I could adequately address. And it's a lot of pressure when it's, you realize that it's people's lives that we're talking about. And it's the, I'm not bragging or nothing, but when it comes to the murder of Matt Stewart, so far, this podcast is in the forum are the only game in town. I don't want that to be the case. but for now it is. So I don't want to mess it up. So that part of that factored into those not being aired out immediately. There are things I'm still following up on, and I want to address them adequately. If I can't do that, then they'll be half finished and more posed as questions. But for all of, you know, what we've talked about, the thing about the ex-boyfriend, the thing about the family member, the thing about the mother-in-law, I truly, sincerely want to work with folks to dispel rumors. I truly do. I don't want this cloud of mystery to continue to bog down this situation. The optimum goal is to be able to work with folks, to be able to present the actual verifiable truth and say, this is what's been talked about, but this is what actually happened. And at the very least, we can all walk away from this podcast knowing more and not as tied up in these he said, she said kind of things. But what I found is that, you know, some people don't want to talk and it becomes difficult at that point. But at the end of the day, it's all going to come out, whether it's incomplete or not. So stay tuned.
So let me ask what would be a very pointed question, and you can edit this out if you feel it's inappropriate to answer it publicly. But is there any real concern based on these rumors that there could be a police involvement, that the investigation itself is compromised?
No, not from the family member.
Okay, that was a very dodgy answer. So if not from the family member,
I don't know if... You know, like I said before, I mean, I think my experience doing this has raised some red flags in my mind, or just some real suspicion about the state of the investigation that probably predisposes me to some speculation of that nature. In terms of reason to believe, I would say no. I wouldn't say I've uncovered anything that would point to that, no.
Are there any other leads like this that have never made it into the podcast?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's multiple people divulging some situations where individual may have had a point of contention with Matt, either stemming from his past or, you know, various other dynamics in his relationships that I've delved in deeper to that may or may not be addressed. You know, I think there are some that certainly will be. There's some that may not be, but there's more than enough to go on for season two, for better or for worse. There's a lot to explore, which for those that are interested in this case is good, but it's bogged down. A lot of the frustration is just trying to weave through what is relevant and what is irrelevant, but it's also, I've had to constantly recognize that the blessing of having people coming forward, even with information that may be irrelevant, at least we're moving in a direction. Originally started the podcast, I knew very little about the case. I knew some of the, what everyone else knew probably. It's just kind of the main story. When I first started, I really didn't know if there was going to be anything to ponder over, if we were going to get anyone to talk to us. And that has turned out not to be the case at all. There's a lot to look at. There's a lot to go on. And a lot of it, honestly, is just time and patience to talk with people, to be persistent, to actually get people on the phone. You know, in the last week, I've talked with someone that I've been literally trying to get an interview with since March. So a lot of it is patience.
Another post on the forum has a copy of the floor plan and the bedroom layout, and it even has a picture of their bedroom from within a year or so of the murder. Do you think that something like this could possibly be used in conjunction with the autopsy to come up with some possible theories as to what actually occurred in that room that night?
Well, first of all, I want to give a huge prayer hands emoji thank you to whoever anonymously provided that picture of the bedroom, because that's huge. I believe in the first Q&A, we asked if there's anyone out there that could get us a floor plan, and someone did. I just think that's phenomenal.
And not only a floor plan, but an actual photo of the bedroom as it was set up at the time of the murder.
Yeah, you guys rock. Can't thank you enough. But yeah, so I think that's huge, and potentially in season two, we can maybe talk with some professionals who could recreate the scenarios, what could have been possible with the single shooter, what could have been possible with two shooters, and trying to make sense of what we've heard happened in the bedroom and what we know from the autopsy and ME report, I think could be very illuminating to the case.
The other thing that we had requested about the same time that we requested this floor plan was somebody coming forward with a copy of the 911 call. We still haven't gotten that, but I still have hope that someone out there somewhere has a copy of that recording. I imagine it's also in the police files. It does exist out there. It's just whether or not we'll be able to get our hands on it.
And I would hope if it's available through public records requests that somebody would have requested it. We know that there was a documentary crew of a legitimate, serious mainstream TV show that was seriously interested in doing a story on the Stewart case and actually came to Mooresville to pursue it. They ended up not pursuing it. And, you know, I wonder if they have a copy.
Ooh, that's a good one. I didn't think of that.
Yeah, I didn't think of that until right now. That's a call I should definitely make, but whether they'd give it to me or not. They could just be waiting. I don't know. Do they still do that show?
I don't know. If they reached that point, they had probably already done a records request for everything that was within their right to get. You don't send a crew out before you have all your background information, right?
Right. Yeah.
So now that you have the first season to look back on, do you feel that you were able to get most of the information that you were looking for from the people that you interviewed?
I would say no in the sense that, you know, I had a very narrow scope when I started because of the very flimsy understanding of the case. So in the course of it, as it is expanded, the questions have multiplied. I've been able to get a lot of answers in some areas, but I think some of the main key folks close to the victim that likely have some of the answers that we're looking for are still not willing to come forward or to speak out publicly about it. So in many ways, I would say no.
Have you gotten actual pushback?
Oh, yeah. It was truly unsettling. Some of the calls that I received and some of the things that were said, I wasn't naive into thinking that I would be welcomed with open arms by everyone as a quasi-reporter or podcaster, whatever you want to call it, looking into an unsolved murder of a well-loved individual. Obviously, it's still very emotional for people involved. I mean, this was a terrible, terrible thing that happened. You know, I expected that not everyone would like what I was doing, but I wasn't expecting the kind of intimidation and kind of directness that I received. And some of the lies that they were told to me directly, it weighs on you, and it's truly been unsettling.
Has anyone actively tried to stop you from continuing?
In what way? Nobody's hit me or anything.
Have people threatened you with legal action or tried to get the police to stop you from?
There have been vague threats of legal action. There were things early on said about the police shutting down the podcast and what the police had said about what I was doing, putting the family in danger. And after those conversations, I called the specific officer that was referenced by the family who had supposedly said all of these things. And those conversations hadn't taken place, in fact, between the officer and the family about my podcast putting them in danger. That was probably one of the first shocking things that happened. But I don't know if there was actual steps taken to shut me down. But, you know, in some ways, they've been open about exploring the options of what they can do to shut the podcast down. And I've been open with them and saying that I invite them to explore those options. Honestly, part of me is curious. Is there a legal way to stop someone in the United States of America from investigating a murder? It's ridiculous to everyone else in the world that my character would be attacked for wanting to shed light on an unsolved murder. Everyone that I talk to, especially people that, you know, reporters, the fellow I talked to from the FBI, people that have been doing this for a long time, that when I've explained the situation to, they've said, "You're kidding me." It hasn't just been calls to my personal phone number. I've gotten calls at the office that I work at in a job that I have completely unrelated to this podcast. I do this podcast on my free time. I'm not getting paid for it. And there have been individuals that have called my office to, I guess, try to report me to my employer for, I don't know, I guess, causing harm by reporting on this murder. I don't know what they expected to happen. They've called the office multiple times, and it was bizarre. If you've come on board listening to this podcast, either from the beginning or you've just binged it now, I'm completely new at this. I don't necessarily know what I'm doing, but I'm not giving up. And hold on. Don't give up on it yet. There's more to come. It's going to be interesting.
Well, I want to thank you for giving us this extra episode that I'm sure most people were not anticipating. I know we all look forward to your second season, and hopefully we can put some more bonus content out between now and then. As always, if you want to get a little bit more detail about some of these topics, you can always visit us at unforgotten.freeforums.net. There's lots of conversations going on there. Leave your own opinions, pass on any rumors or thoughts that you've heard, and remember that just because you've heard something for years doesn't mean that everybody else is aware of it.
Unforgotten is a Bold Era production, written and recorded by myself, Freddie Wilson, in the always sunny Daytona Beach, Florida. As always, this series is dedicated to the life of Matt Stewart. May his memory remain unforgotten.